This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
I think that maybe Putin's biggest mistake from his own perspective was not going all in 2014, because he had a disunited Ukraine who would have caught the world by surprise, and he would have had probably a much easier time at it, especially given the fact that it seems as if Russia's military modernization after 2008 didn't do very much to change their fighting doctrine. So those extra 8 years of military reform probably would not have done much to move the needle.
Everyone, this is AJ Woodhams, host of the War Books podcast, where I interview today's best authors writing about war-related topics. Today, I am really excited to have on the show Samuel Romany for his new book, Putin's War in Ukraine, Russia's Campaign for Global Counter-Revolution. Samuel teaches politics and international relations at the University of Oxford. He is the author of Russia in Africa and an associate fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. He contributes regularly to Foreign Policy, The Washington Post, the BBC World Service, Al Jazeera, and CNN. Samuel, how are you doing today?
Doing very well. How about you?
I'm great. And we were just chatting a little bit before we started recording about some of the really interesting Russia-Ukraine books that are out right now. And your book specifically, I thought was great for giving like a whole history of this war, and focusing too on some of the more global elements to it, which don't often get talked so much. So thinking about like Syria and the Middle East and Africa and China, I thought that you had some really interesting ideas. So very excited to hear you talk a little bit about them. Maybe first off, could you just start by telling our audience here, what is your book about in your own words?
So basically the book basically tries to explain why did Putin launch a full-scale invasion of Ukraine instead of a more limited risk, but predictable intervention in the Donbass. The second was, why did the Russian military fail so spectacularly in achieving its initial goals in to produce regime change in Kiev and take over the vast majority of the country territorially? And also, how did Vladimir Putin manage to survive this catastrophic failure, even in the face of Western sanctions? And also, how has Russia managed to position itself on the world stage, even though it's largely isolated from the West? How resilient and how durable are its partnerships in the post-Soviet space and also in the collective non-West, like China, India, Iran? That's really what the book seeks to cover. So the majority of the book's content really focuses on the period from the first mobilization in the spring of 2021 onto the second mobilization, followed by the invasion itself and then the war. But there are also a few chapters at the beginning which deal with some of the formative and critical developments that led up to this point. So events like the 2004 Orange Revolution in Ukraine, that it created Putin's fear of liberal democracy and popular revolutions in Ukraine, that later built into the Euromaidan Revolution, and also unrelated developments like the Arab Spring, the Syrian Civil War, and things, the NATO expansion, things that kind of shaped Putin's anti-Western thinking. So it really describes what happened in Putin's Russia to make this war possible, and then granular analysis of how the war has unfolded over the first year of its duration.
Yeah, and the subtitle of your book really caught my eye. So the Campaign for Global Counter-Revolution. I feel like that's like a very, I don't know, that sounds scary a little bit, but explain what you mean by that title. Like, what is global counter-revolution?
So basically, one of my arguments, one of my key contentions in this book is that this is not just a war in Ukraine. This is not just a war to recapture the former Soviet Union and reconstitute Russian greatness in a territorial sense. Putin's war in Ukraine is also a war against the liberal international order and also against liberal democracy more broadly. So counter-revolution means overturning the outcomes of democratic popular uprisings, the popular revolutions. So it's about autocracy promotion, and it's about undermining the impact of these episodes of popular unrest. And I think a core reason why Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine in February 2022 and sought to overthrow Vladimir Zelensky was because Zelensky was a product of the 2014 Euromaidan revolution. And he was representative of a democratic experiment that was underway in Ukraine that could create an alternative model of governance for post-Soviet states to what was being offered inside Russia with Putin's Russia. So an alternative, successful, democratic model. And this is something that was quite alarming and scary for Vladimir Putin, and something that he could not tolerate on his doorstep. So it's something that he had to overturn and had to change and had to prevent. And when you look at the entire history of Putin's Russia, you see a consistent trend of escalating responses to popular unrest and popular revolutions, even when Putin's regime has appeared to be getting more and more authoritarian, more and more secure. So in the early 2000s, the Bulldozer Revolution in Serbia, the Rose Revolution in Georgia, the 2004 Revolution in Ukraine were greeted with frustration, but little more than rhetorical criticisms and small-scale election meddling. Then we started seeing Vladimir Putin seek to undo the impacts of those revolutions through invading South Ossetia in Georgia in 2008, which threatened the Saakashvili government's hold on key parts of its territory. And then engaging in various forms of economic warfare against Yushchenko's Ukraine in the hopes of undoing the Orange Revolution. And then we saw the Arab Spring come in and the 2012 protests in Moscow and Blatnaya Square make him even more fearful of these episodes of unrest, followed by the revolution in Euromaidan in Ukraine, which led to the invasion of Crimea and Donbass, and then the revolution in Syria, which led to Russia sending fighter jets alongside Iranian forces to help keep Bashar al-Assad in power. And then finally, the 2020 unrest in Belarus, where Russia did use a variety of tactics to prop up Alexander Lukashenko and prevent the demise of his closest ally and his in near neighbor, autocrat, who was kind of following a similar model of governance. So as you can see, over the course of 20 years, you see a consistent thread of opposition to popular unrest and popular revolutions, and also drastic escalation in means of resisting them, from criticizing them to delegitimizing them to limited military interventions to full-scale invasions like we're seeing now in Ukraine. And finally, it's interesting because I think the counter-revolution represents Russia's conservative values, Russia's illiberal values. And it's a way of uniting the Russian people around a common set of ideas and creating a new contemporary Russian foreign policy identity. Because after the collapse of communism, after the collapse of the Soviet Union's superpower status, Russia was left rudderless. It didn't really have a sense of purpose as a country. It really didn't know what it stood for on the world stage. Was it a part of the West? Was it a part of the East? Was it something else entirely? Was it a different Orthodox civilization? It didn't really know who it was. And it was often quoted in the 1990s that even our subregions, like the Chechens and the republics that we ruled over, like the Kazakhs, have a clearer sense of who they are than we do. And counter-revolution, opposing popular uprisings, opposing liberal democracy, opposing these liberal values, allowed Vladimir Putin to unite large swathes of the Russian people around anti-Westernism, illiberalism, and his variant of conservatism. And that, I think, is crucial for his regime security and also for convincing the Russians that they have a place in the world and something that they're standing for on the world stage. And finally, there's a long history here. This narrative of popular revolutions being fake, of popular revolutions being conduits or vehicles for the expansion of malign and nefarious Western influence are very, very similar to the narratives that Russians have been hearing for about 50 or 60 years. From the 1953 unrest in East Germany to the 1956 unrest in Hungary, 1968 in Czechoslovakia, 1993 constitutional crisis in Russia, revolutions and protests were equated with fascism. They were equated with Nazi infiltration. When the Soviets went into Hungary, they thought they were told, the Soviet troops were told they were fighting Nazis in Hungary. Just like the same way the current Russian troops are being told that they're fighting Nazis inside Ukraine. And this image of the of Western-backed instability and revolutions being a conduit or a vehicle for values that are alien to Russia's is something that can resonate from people who grew up under Putin's Russia or to people who grew up in the Second World War. All generations are united here. And that's why I think counter-revolution and this overturning of Euromaidan, this pursuit of regime change in Ukraine, was so essential and so central to Putin's decision to invade.
Yeah, and you know, that's so interesting. And I mean, since we're talking about, you know, global counter-revolution, I was going to ask you about this later in the interview, but I think if you would have asked me, I'm not an expert, but I think if you would have asked most people before the invasion of Ukraine, I think there would be consensus that Russia was meddling in the affairs of a lot of countries in the West, whether that's, you know, 2016 election interference, or that's poisoning dissidents in the UK or targeting journalists. And, you know, I'm curious, now that Russia has invaded Ukraine, do you think they still have that kind of global reach that the West was very fearful of before their invasion? Do you think they still have those capabilities?
Well, I mean, I think that they certainly have the ability to continue to carry out election interference, I think, and affect the outcomes in Western countries. I mean, obviously, some of their tools have been stripped because of the invasion of Ukraine. I think the closure of RT and Sputnik is a big loss for them in terms of being able to amplify messages that are favorable to them. But we should also not underestimate the number of surrogates that they still manage to have, particularly on the far left and the far right of the political spectrum, especially in continental Europe. So people who are opposed to the economic consequences of this war and believe that sanctions on Russia are leading to higher energy prices, higher food prices, there's a slice of the population for whom that narrative would resonate, and those people are pushing for a political settlement. But the problem is, Russia's ability to influence outcomes inside Western countries is limited now by its limited popularity and limited appeal. I mean, there was a new Pew Research survey, the highest level of support for Russia that was observed in continental Europe or in the entire collective West, as the Russians like to call it, was Greece, 32%. Almost every single country has got overwhelmingly unfavorable images of Russia, and now the Russian media outlets are gone. So they have to rely on kind of lone wolf surrogates to kind of promote their messaging and promote their narratives. And those surrogates are largely clustered on the far left and the far right of the political spectrum in most countries. Of course, there are some elements of that becoming a bit more mainstream. So maybe Trump and DeSantis in the United States a little bit, and also people like Orban in Hungary, maybe taking some of the narratives that they're pushing and bringing them into more of into the popular domain, or Marine Le Pen in France. But in general, Russia's ability to influence is largely radicalizing those who are already radicalized and are already kind of suspicious of the establishment and the institutions and the system, and just fanning the flames and making it worse. Elsewhere outside the West, however, I think that Russia's got a greater ability to kind of be able to influence outcomes and engage in political interference, because I don't think that Prigozhin's machinery, the Wagner Group's chief machinery, is necessarily going away. His media outlets and his political technologists have been shuttered, but RT chief, Margarita Simonian, says they're the best in the business and they want to hire them. Also, Russian diplomats are being expelled from Europe. Many of those are spies and who are experienced in various tactics of political interference and espionage. Where are they going to go? They're not off the payroll of the Kremlin. They're going to be stacking and staffing the embassies in sub-Saharan Africa, in the Middle East, in the Indo-Pacific region. And we're seeing an expansion of Russia's media presence in those regions as well. Everywhere from RT landing in South Africa or in Serbia, or Sputnik Francophone channels gaining massive ground in West Africa from Tunisia, crowding on French outlets, and also Chinese outlets reinforcing Russian disinformation in places where Russia can't reach. I think that Russia's information warfare, their ability to meddle in other countries' affairs, promote autocracy in the global South, is alive and well, and maybe even stronger as a result of this war. So as you can see, it's a mixed picture. I mean, I think that they're able to more effectively radicalize the extremes in the West, but not necessarily the mainstream opinion. But in the global South, they're able to run riot, and I think they are a serious threat to anybody who believes in liberal democracy.
Yeah, and I think one thing that I found was interesting this week, thinking about Prigozhin, is as we're recording this week, there was a video of him that came out where he's like, you know, all right, you know, Wagner mercenaries, like, we're pulling out of Ukraine and we're going to Africa. And I'm like, what? Like, I didn't realize that Russia, that Africa was so strategically important to Russia. As somebody who's written a book about, you know, Russia in Africa, talk a little bit about that, that importance that in the global South, as you call it, that Russia is putting on that region.
So yeah, it's great that we talk about this right now, because next week is going to be the Russia-Africa Summit in St. Petersburg, where Russia is expecting dozens of African leaders to be in attendance and hoping that the aftermath of the scrapping the Black Sea grain export deal and effectively taking measures to starve the poorest people in Africa is not going to lead to African countries turning on Russia. And oddly enough, so far that hasn't seemed to happen. Nobody believes in is talking very much. But yeah, it's interesting that Yevgeny Prigozhin would be trying to beef up and strengthen Wagner's presence in Africa, because he knows that Wagner is indispensable over there for Russia's influence and its operations. This can't easily be dislodged. Their forces are guarding Libya's vital oil ports. They're guarding the main gold mines in Sudan. They're serving as bodyguards for the president of Central African Republic. They're fighting in shared military bases in Mali against counterterrorism. And you can't change those personnel overnight without severely disrupting counterterrorism operations and risking oil and gold and other vital mineral reserves that bring hard currency to the Kremlin falling into hostile hands. So Prigozhin is fairly smug about his position in Africa and fairly confident that he's going to be able to continue to exert influence. And I think he's going to still try to market his services to other countries as well. We've already been seeing the Russians try to market their services more aggressively in coastal West Africa and also some of the countries surrounding Central African Republic, particularly both Congo's and Cameroon. How far they'll be able to go, given now the doubts about Wagner and the Russian state having this falling out, it's unclear. But they're definitely going to be trying to have an interest over there. And the reason why Putin needs to tolerate Prigozhin in Africa, and Africa is important for him, is severalfold. First of all, is a practical consideration. Obviously, Russia is shorn of its Western partners, and it needs to really rebalance its foreign policy towards the non-West. One of the stated goals of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, if you listen to Dmitry Medvedev or Sergei Lavrov or any of the leading Russian officials, is that we're trying to create a more equitable global order. We're trying to create a multipolar world order. And multipolarity means embracing the other poles of the international system that are not the United States and Europe. So embracing China, India, Africa, Brazil, the Persian Gulf monarchies, Iran, you get the picture, right? A various range of regional and great and aspiring great powers in the collective non-West that Russia needs to strengthen its partnerships with. The second thing, obviously, is that Africa remains a fairly lucrative, if small, market for some of the extractives that Russia can invest in. Like, you know, Russian mining companies have considerable presences there. So everything from Rosatom and nuclear energy to El Rosa Diamond, Rusal for bauxite and aluminum, then also, of course, the energy companies like Gazprom and Lukoil and others. And also, Russia's traditionally been the largest arms supplier to Africa, though that may be called into question because of doubts about the efficacy of Russian military technology and the tighter secondary sanctions risks that we're seeing. So that's why Egypt, for example, didn't buy the Su-35s and Iran had to purchase them, and they're still working all that out. And the third thing, obviously, is symbolic for Russia, because the Soviet Union had a history of superpower status in Africa. Africa was the flagship theater of their decolonization, their resistance to imperialism, and Russia frames its current influence in Africa in exactly the same terms. Like, it is fighting Western neocolonialism. It's fighting French neocolonialism in West Africa, claiming the French are not fighting terrorists, they're just seizing mines, right? They're fighting American interference. And backing people like Assimi Goïta is like the same way the Soviet Union tried to make overtures towards African liberation heroes like Kwame Nkrumah in Ghana, right? Goïta is the military junta dictator in Mali, for those who are not following this so closely. So, as you can see, that Africa was an integral part of the Soviet Union's image as a anti-imperial, anti-Western power. and superpower status there was important for that. And now, as Russia sees itself as the inheritor of many of the elements of Soviet greatness, without the Marxist-Leninist ideology, but still the image of greatness and superpower status that it wants to inherit, it sees influence in Africa as a natural continuity. So it's about status, it's about extractives, and it's about multipolarity.
Yeah, well, you know, thinking about Putin's goal to reclaim the same kind of influence that the Soviet Union had, you know, maybe let's talk about a big question from your book, which could be a hard question maybe to answer, because you have taken several hundred pages to write about it. But why do you think that that Putin opted for a full-scale invasion of Ukraine rather than just continuing his small-scale intervention in the Donbass?
Well, there were several calculations that were at play over here. I think the first was underestimation of both Ukrainian and Western resolve. So he was being basically reading the Kool-Aid and taking it all in. He basically was believing that the large portions of the Ukrainian population, especially those who were ethnic Russian or even Russian language speakers, not even ethnically Russians, would turn and support Russia and greet Russia as liberators. So the narrative for 8 years leading up to the 2022 invasion, so after Euromaidan, was that the government in Kiev was illegally installed. It was legally installed by the United States, and it was radicalized and it was extremist, right? It was dominated and effectively Zelensky was being held hostage by Nazi and fascist battalions. And those Nazi battalions and fascist battalions and Zelensky, by extension, were inherently Russophobic and were trying to extinguish Russian culture, Russian language, and the Russian ethnicity from Ukraine, to the point in which they came up with this idea that ethnic Russians in Donbass were actually being victims of genocide. And while this seems like an alternate reality, it's something that was repeated in the Russian media day in and day out for 8 years, and it seemed to infiltrate the views of some of Putin's closest advisors, like the hawkish national security advisor Nikolai Patrushev, or the head of the FSB, Alexander Bortnikov, or Dmitry Medvedev, or many of these other figures who he was listening to in the days and months leading up to the invasion almost exclusively because he was hiding his plans from everyone else. So this groupthink really, I think, influenced Vladimir Putin to believe that large numbers of Ukrainians would be on side. At the very least, he would have the support of the second largest political party inside Ukraine, which is Viktor Medvedchuk's opposition bloc. And at most, he would have grassroots local resistance that he'd be able to tap in on and be able to move forward. Of course, this was a contradiction of modern history, because Russia had exactly the same set of assumptions in 2014 and 2015, and they were so confident in those assumptions that they didn't even declare war. They didn't even officially send their own ground troops. They just sent separatists and proxies to take over, and they hoped that they would be able to go all the way from Crimea to Kharkiv to Odessa and create Novorossiya, one-third of the country being liberated. They did take over Crimea. They did succeed in Donetsk and Luhansk because of the chaos that followed Yanukovych's leadership. But as soon as Ukraine, even when it lacked NATO-class weaponry, even when it was demoralized by years of underfunding of its military under Yanukovych and was divided as a society, was able to even create some kind of resistance, Russia was unable to advance. And those ethnic Russians and those Russian speakers fought on the side of the Ukrainians, not on the side of Russia. But because of the groupthink and because of these 8 years of propaganda, because of Putin's reliance on a very small, close circle of advisors, he had this alternate reality in his head that large portions of Ukrainians would be greeted as liberators. And that extended from Putin down to the 18-year-old Russian conscripts on the ground who were shocked that they were being spat on and assaulted when they landed in Ukrainian territory because they told their mothers they thought we were coming here to liberate people who were suffering under Nazi oppression. So that's kind of one arc of it. The second was obviously the underestimation of the West, and that was somewhat more rational because Western countries had always talked a big game but underperformed when it came to countering Russian aggression in the past. Russia invaded Georgia in 2008, and there were no sanctions that were imposed or no divestment from Russian energy inside the West. Russia carried out atrocities like some of the very similar kind that we're seeing in Ukraine, in Chechnya, including the use of filtration camps and the mass leveling of cities. Like think about Bakhmut and think about Mariupol and go back to Grozny. And there wasn't even more than just a mere slap on the wrist. There was talk about engaging with Russia and bringing Russia into the collective West. They carry out war crimes with fighter jets and bomb schools and hospitals in Syria. No sanctions. they annex Crimea. A small number of elites get sanctioned, and Germany expands its dependence on Russian gas by signing Nord Stream 2 just months later. So Vladimir Putin believed that the same thing would happen again, and the Western response would be just as feckless. The Western societies would be divided between the political extremes, and the far left and the far right, and populist economic sentiments would deter serious sanctions. And also, the West would not supply large-scale military technology to Ukraine because they'd be able to use the nuclear weapons card to scare and thwart any movement of artillery, fighter jets, anything of any substance. So they figured that they were going to be able to succeed, and they were fighting against a disunited Ukrainian army and a Ukrainian society that had substantial support for them. So that was one big decision why he believed that the invasion of Ukraine would be something that was low cost and very high reward. It was almost a guarantee to succeed. And you see that because Russia only planned for supply lines of 2 to 3 days on many of their early interventions into Kiev. And troops just ran out of cold weather gear. They ran out of food. They ran out of things that they should never have run out of if they had planned an intervention properly. And they had only one supply station. For the U.S. military would have 3 to 5, and the Russia puts 1 because they don't think they need them, right? So that's just an interesting contradiction and point. Another thing, I think, was that Vladimir Putin wanted a legacy-defining achievement, I think, and undoing the Euromaidan revolution, kind of reuniting the core parts of the Russian empire, as he saw it, Ukraine, Russia, Belarus, under a common destiny and a common set of leaders. So having somebody like Medvedchuk or Yanukovych in Ukraine, Lukashenko in Belarus, Putin in Russia, all autocratic, anti-Western, kind of a united conservative axis here, would be kind of his defining legacy. And that's kind of what I think he saw this being. Because in the first decade of his time in power, it was stabilization of the country after the 1990s and defusing the Chechen separatism threat and economic growth. The second decade, it was reclaiming Crimea and rebuilding the Russian military. In his third and what may well be his final decade in office, it would be reuniting the Russian world. So I think that was the other reason why he wanted to go big and go all in, and he thought the costs were limited, and he ended up being extremely wrong on all fronts.
Wow. Well, you actually summarized several hundred pages very succinctly there. So thank you for that. A couple of things that I think are really interesting that you just said. One is Putin's isolation. But actually, first, I want to ask you about when you were talking about the West and Crimea. How much of a mistake do you think it was in 2014 that Putin seemed to receive hardly any consequences for his invasion of Crimea from the global stage?
Well, I think that was very significant, I think, and it really kind of created a bit of a false picture of what might happen later on. And there was only one military columnist, Mikhail Karyanok, the retired colonel, who wrote an article in Russia Gazeta, who warned that the West would be much more that supportive of Ukraine this time around, because Ukraine had been integrated much more into NATO structures from drills in the Sea of Azov and the Black Sea than it was then. So he assumed that, yeah, there was going to be no major Western support for Ukraine. No Western country gave lethal arms to Ukraine. Lithuania was the first. It was years later. Trump authorized the Javelins in 2019 to come to Ukraine. Obama didn't give any kind of military assistance at the time. So there was a history of the West not backing Ukraine, and also the West not sanctioning Russia anywhere near severely enough, because in 2014, they were the official rhetoric, when I was talking to people in Moscow from advisors like Sergei Karaganov, was that they were shocked that Germany even sanctioned Russia at all. So they were shocked that some sanctions were there. But privately, they actually were expecting sanctions to get much more severe than they actually were. Alexei Kudrin, one of the key economic advisors, actually drew up a plan for what Russia would do in the event of Russia being kicked out of SWIFT in the summer of 2014. Or even if one country did this, like Britain, for example, decided to do it in the aftermath of Brexit, if they just did it all by themselves, what would that be? And they already were concluding that, you know, they can try to figure out ways to keep GDP decline to less than 5%. And they were kind of coming up with strategies for this. So the Russians had a lot of bravado and a lot of confidence that, you see, the West is going to do nothing because they need us. But privately, even they, I think, were surprised by the weakness of the Western response. And that just encouraged them to go further and Putin to kind of push the boundaries as far as possible. So I think that was a very serious blow. And combined on the heels of that with a non-reaction to what they just did in Syria, I think that was a gateway to moving this forward. And finally, I think the very fact that, you know, the 2016 interference in the U.S. elections, as egregious as that may have been as an attack on liberal democracy, did lead to sanctions. It did lead to so much coverage, but Russia's international ventures were barely greeted with a slap on the wrist. Led Russian policymakers to conclude that Russia was becoming an issue of domestic politics and not really necessarily being viewed in national security threat terms. So if the Russians attacked Ukraine, but didn't necessarily combine that with some kind of hybrid attacks on the United States, the U.S. response would be very limited. I think that overemphasis and overdramatization to some extent of attacks on the home front and lack of dealing in a similar way or in a more severe way with attacks abroad kind of convinced Russia to escalate in the manner that they did too. That's another narrative I was hearing in the Kremlin between 2014 and 2020. So I wanted to bring that up.
Yeah, well, I mean, very famously, I think in like the 2012 U.S. elections, the candidates were speaking about Russia as a regional power and very much discounting like their influence around the globe. This might be kind of a hard situation for us to imagine, but I'm curious if the war right now was being fought in 2014, how do you think that would be different?
That would have been interesting. I think that, first of all, Ukraine would have been in a much weaker position than it was right now because the Ukraine's intelligence services were severely compromised by collusion and cooperation with the Russian security services, so much so that when the Russian forces went into Crimea, there was actually bases and installations where the people just fled, and they even left their computers and their IT and all kinds of valuable information for the Russians to pick up and to collect. And there were also a lot of very active collaborators who would have helped and steered it from the ground. So Yanukovych probably would have retreated to the east and then probably stayed there. And Medvedchuk would have been doing his work in terms of facilitating and moving this. There were even corrupt dealings between Medvedchuk, which is Russia's preferred successor in Ukraine, and Putin is the godfather of his daughter, and Petro Poroshenko, which were later revealed onward. So Russia had a much greater ability to exercise soft power, spread disinformation, use local surrogates, corrupt even officials who were against Russia's side, and create confusion and create chaos. And also the Ukrainian military lacked NATO-class equipment. It had been severely hollowed out in the previous two decades. And there were high rate of defections from the intelligence services, as I just noted. And I think that that would have meant that the Russians would have gained substantially more territory before the West would have been able to have kicked in with weapons deliveries. And we probably would have looked at Russia probably retaking, maybe even Novorossiya, and then the West may have finally only been able to have woken up when Kiev itself was under threat. And then we would have seen a protracted and long war, which may have ended in very well in some kind of a frozen conflict, because it may have been just too much territory for the Ukrainians to dislodge from Russia at one time. So I think that maybe Putin's biggest mistake from his own perspective was not going all in 2014, because he had a disunited Ukraine who would have caught the world by surprise, and he would have had probably a much easier time at it, especially given the fact that it seems as if Russia's military modernization after 2008 didn't do very much to change their fighting doctrine. So those extra 8 years of military reform probably would not have done much to move the needle.
That's very interesting. Well, I'm curious about something else that you had mentioned in regards to Putin's isolation. So this became very apparent to everybody during the pandemic when you would see images of Vladimir Putin. You know, he was at the long table and he was physically isolated from everybody. But as you noted, you know, he's really just had like a small group of people that, you know, his inner circle that he relies on. And so he has been very isolated in terms of the knowledge that he receives. I'm curious, how isolated is he still, given what's gone on with like the Prigozhin mutiny, given that the war, I think from any angle, it's not going well and it's not what he expected. How isolated does he remain?
So what happened was, I think that he had a tendency to make decisions of these kind of military interventions with a very small circle of leaders. And the same exact decision-making process was used in the annexation of Crimea in 2014. Even Sergei Lavrov was not in the room when that decision was made by all the accounts of experts I interviewed inside Russia and also in the U.S. who are familiar with Russian decision-making. And he, I think in this invasion too, he was caught off guard because Lavrov the previous day was saying that the invasion was not going to happen. And then he had to come with his UN team and come up with some kind of Article 51 national self-defense case to justify the invasion. And it seems like a bit of a scattershot thing. So it's very likely that Vladimir Putin in both of these interventions merely consulted with his national security team and the head of the FSB, and maybe some people in the top of the military top brass like Shoigu and Gerasimov. And I would say that Patrushev, for example, from the national security team, may have been an influencer on policy and steering him in this direction, whereas Shoigu was merely an implementer and a passive implementer. So that's kind of how it would have looked like. So the number of influencers, even in that group of five or six, may have only been two or three. So this gives you a sense of how close circle these decisions are made on issues like the war in Ukraine. I don't think that necessarily extends, though, to every single issue. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. One of the things I note, for example, in Russia and Africa, the other book, is a striking degree to which decision-making there is actually coming from the bottom up. It's coming from state-owned companies. It's coming from individuals like Prigozhin. It's coming from Duma members and Federation Council members and advisors to the president. And Vladimir Putin just kind of takes the agenda in broad terms and does the trips and does the things and kind of lets these guys run it and just gives a thumbs up. So I wouldn't say that he was always isolated and the COVID isolation was just extending to every aspect of policy. It's just that he keeps a very, very high degree of paranoia and secrecy about these highest level national security issues. And he wants to use these issues maybe to kind of unite the bureaucracy, pit people against each other. Maybe that's probably why he's doing that, because it doesn't seem to make much operational sense not to get as wide a range of opinions as possible on the same thing. So I think it's less the COVID isolation, but more how he just has a pattern of conducting himself, tending to put the most high-level security issues that could lead to profound changes in Russian society and potentially pose threats and opportunities for regime consolidation, being determined by a small group of like-minded advisors and the rest of policy being having other figures. And I think that as the war has proceeded, he has gotten much more hands-on and on the ground in terms of figuring out what's happening. There's lots of reports, for example, that Vladimir Putin talks regularly to generals and even levels below general, to military figures to find out what's happening on the front lines without Shoigu and Gerasimov's consent. He's actively involved, of course, in the regular rotations that we're seeing in the southern, central, and other military districts and personnel changes that we keep seeing on the ground because he's frustrated with how they're performing and he keeps trying to reassign them. And he's outsourced large amounts of domestic policy, I think especially economic policy, to his prime minister, Mikhail Mishustin. So he's capable of delegation. He's capable of consultation. It's not about a state of mind. It's just about how he wants to micromanage and also is a bit paranoid when he's handling these very, very high-level security issues and high-risk interventions.
Yeah, well, thinking about his kind of close circle of advisors and thinking about Shoigu and Gerasimov and the Prigozhin mutiny, which was very directed at their failures, not Putin's failures, at their failures. I'm curious how, they obviously remain in their jobs and they obviously remain in Putin's circle. How important are both of them individually to Putin? And I guess, how is Putin receiving the criticism against them and what actions does he take in response to that?
So it was interesting because Prigozhin's speech, which I think is very, very important to understand the mutiny, even more important than some of the gesticulations that he did before, like talking about how the Russian defense minister were attacking his forces. That speech is very revealing of what his grievances towards the Russian military leadership were. And his argument was basically that Sergei Shoigu was corrupt. He was kind of pursuing his own ambitions and basically effectively squandering Russia's military resources and reforms to probably enrich himself. And also he was working in conjunction with oligarchs whose sole purpose was to plunder Ukraine, right? And Putin was kind of seen as a figure who was incompetent and unable to deal with or manage what the people underneath him were doing. Like Shoigu and the oligarchs were planning all this and they were able to pull wool over his eyes, deceive him, and Putin didn't stop it. So so that Putin was deceived into believing that the people of Donbass were experiencing genocide, that NATO was about to expand under Russia's borders, and that Ukraine was going to be used as a launch pad to attack Russia itself, all these type of things. So Prigozhin's and the Wagner Group mutiny was, yes, first and foremost, aimed at changing the Russian military leadership. And I have doubts as to whether he actually intended to overthrow Vladimir Putin on the day, or rather try to get to the gates of Moscow and blackmail Putin almost into firing these figures and replacing them with people like the disappeared general Sergei Surovikin, or Teplinsky, who was rumored to replace Gerasimov, and then that rumor died down, and people like that. So, but also, he was taking a direct aim at Putin's leadership and also Putin's ability to manage his subordinates. And I think that may have been why that was a real red line for him, right? Like, in terms of the future inside Putin's inner circle, more so than some of the other dramatics that he had carried out before, like standing in front of the corpses and crying about munitions and accusing the defense ministry of treason and other stuff that he had done, because he was attacking Putin himself there. I mean, that's an important thing to bring up. I think that with regards to Shoigu and Gerasimov, I think that Shoigu is been long-term positioned in the role. He's been there since 2012. He's manage the interventions in Ukraine and also Syria. To some degree, though, I think the actual credit for the successes were probably the generals on the ground, like Dvornikov and, to some extent, largely Sergei Surovikin, and their coordination with Assad, Iran, and Hezbollah. He was largely just overseeing personnel and equipment and things like that. He's a minister of emergencies before that. He doesn't have a military background. He's not especially respected by the military top brass, by veterans, by the FSB, or by, for that matter, Putin, but he's somebody who runs the military in administratively efficient enough way, and even if he's not strategically sound, and even though he's got corruption and vulnerabilities, he's not going to have ambitions to replace Putin and try to overthrow him and try to disrupt the apple cart and disrupt the system. He, by keeping Shoigu in power, the military is effectively coup-proofed. So that's probably why I think that Shoigu has stayed in place, and Shoigu is unlikely to be removed in the near future. Gerasimov is a slightly different kettle of fish, because Gerasimov actually was a contributor to Russia's military doctrines and military reforms. There's two figures, right? There's Serdyukov, the first defense minister before Shoigu, who was seen as too much willing to challenge authority, which is why Shoigu, who was more pliable, was put in. And Gerasimov, who came up with their hybrid war doctrine. So their doctrine of, you know, cyber warfare, their doctrine of using proxies and surrogates, information warfare. And that doctrine has proven to be ineffective in Ukraine because they couldn't influence Ukrainian public opinion to be pro-Russian. They haven't carried out any meaningful cyber attacks. And their ability to use proxies and surrogates like the Luhansk and Donetsk militias or Chechen Khodorovtsy have been marred by chaos and infighting and a lot of problems. But Gerasimov is the antidote at this point to the ultra-nationalists who are posing a threat to his regime. Surovikin was clearly demoted and replaced by him to be running the forces in Ukraine. So I don't think that Putin for the near future will dismiss him, because doing so would be kind of acknowledging that the ultranationalists were right and would give them some oxygen. Just today, one of the biggest ultranationalist critics of Putin, Igor Girkin, was just detained. So that's a sign that he's really trying to crack down on that bloc and not try to empower them. So of the two, I think Gerasimov was more of a contributor to the failed war, and therefore he's more vulnerable to being dismissed than Shoigu, but he's not likely to be dismissed in the current climate either, because of the ultranationalist threat and the fact that Russia just wants to clamp down on these people and not give them concessions.
Yeah, and that's very interesting that what you say, because even if Putin wanted to dismiss Gerasimov or Shoigu, to do that would be almost like an admission of his own failure. It would make him look weak, like he could not manage them. So that is very interesting. I want to pivot a little bit here and talk about Syria, which has been brought up a few times. What is the relationship like right now between Russia and Syria?
Well, I think that Russia has largely achieved its major objectives in Syria as they were defined when they intervened in 2015. So I was in Moscow when the intervention in Syria began, and they framed their operation in very much Bush doctrine type terms. We have to expel ISIS from Syria. We have to fight the terrorists before the terrorists end up in the North Caucasus, right? So it's like we have to attack Iraq before the WMDs end up in the streets of our cities. It's the same kind of analogy, almost the same rhetoric. and such an irony, given how much Vladimir Putin has spent the past 20 years attacking U.S. unilateralism and U.S. Military interventions. But that was what they set the goal to be. Obviously, they played a relatively minimal role in the actual defeat of ISIS because 92 to 94% of their strikes were targeted and focused on various Syrian opposition groups and also some affiliated to al-Qaeda, like Jabhat al-Nusra, but also many who were just grassroots opposition groups. And the U.S. did the heavy lifting in terms of the fight against ISIS. So ISIS has been defeated in Syria for the most part, which is good for him. And also, Assad has managed to take control over the integral parts of the country. He's managed to take over, secure Damascus, take over Aleppo, take over Palmyra and some other surrounding cities, and effectively just some pockets of Idlib in the Kurdish areas are all that are left. So Russia does not need to really do much in Syria these days, aside from just giving Assad the degree of air support and the degree of naval support and the personnel on the ground for training and logistics to make sure Assad keeps what he has. So that's why the frequency of airstrikes in Syria after the war in Ukraine began reached an all-time low. And that's why, you know, after the Moskva cruiser was sunk, there wasn't that much disruption to Russia's intervention in Syria like some predicted, because it doesn't need those kind of heavy equipments anymore to function and to develop. In the longer term, I think that Russia is going to play a wait-and-see approach and be very patient in Syria, because it, Iran, and Damascus are all under international sanctions. So the question is, who gets the sanctions lifted first? Will countries like the UAE, who have been lobbying for ceasefire sanctions in Syria to be lifted to rebuild the country, get some kind of a concession on Syria? Will there be a JCPOA that brings Iran to see its sanctions lifted? Or will there be some kind of a ceasefire or deal with Russia or something that leads to Russia seeing some more freedom to maneuver and to invest? And right now, neither of those three scenarios are very likely, so they can't really engage in the reconstruction process. But when one of those or multiple of those scenarios kick in, they want to make sure that they outflank Iran and that they're first in line for the oil, the petrochemicals, and the other areas of the Syrian economy where their companies have quietly been making outreaches and deals in the event that that does happen. And the second thing I think they want is to maintain a long-term military presence in the Mediterranean and the Middle East in Syria, and that means modernizing their bases in Tartus and Khmeimim and making sure they keep them for a minimum of 50 years. So I think that that's really what their end game is in Syria. And also, they've achieved something else. They've gotten Syria into the Arab League again. And they've managed to de-escalate somewhat Syria's tensions with Turkey, even though the Turkish military presence on the border remains. So they've achieved most of what they want. The next steps are reconstruction and staying there for the remainder of this half century or maybe even century.
I'm curious if there's anything in the reverse direction. So Iran is supplying their drones to the Russians to use in Ukraine. What is Syria supplying anything to the Russians to use in Ukraine, whether that's manpower or equipment or anything?
No, there's really no evidence of that. There were rumors that Syria would supply barrel bombs that it used to Russia. And that's still a possibility, given the fact that the U.S. has given Ukraine cluster munitions. But that never really got off the ground. And there were also rumors that Syria was going to actually maybe even send foreign fighters or ground forces, or the Russians were trying to gin up enthusiasm for that. There was that famous rally in Damascus University where Syrian students were wearing the flag colors of the Syrian Arab Republic flag formed a Z. And there were some gestures like this to try to encourage and inspire support for the war in Ukraine. But the vast majority of the Syrian people see themselves, particularly the Syrian Sunnis and also the Syrian Kurds, see themselves as being victims of Russian aggression, directly or indirectly. And they view basically in Syria, and they have a lot of solidarity with Ukraine. There's plenty of Syrian opposition fighters who are wearing Ukrainian flags, many more of them than Syrian pro-government people carrying Zets. So I think in general, there's not much enthusiasm for bringing forces into Russia. I don't think that the barrel bombs are going to be transferred also to Russia, even if they might prove to be useful, however brutal they may be, for some of Russia's attacks on Ukrainian cities.
And you bring up cluster bombs. Do you think that is a mistake to supply cluster bombs from the U.S. to Ukraine?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a complicated question, a complicated situation. I think that it's something that the U.S. would rather not have done, I think. I think given the fact that it's the only weapon shipment in modern times that's really polarized and divided the NATO alliance, because so many countries in NATO have signed on to the opposition to the ban on cluster munitions. So something they would have rather not done, but there were some strategic reasons why it may have been a necessary move. Number one, Russia's been using cluster munitions on the front lines, and Ukraine does have its stocks of Soviet-era cluster munitions that it's used to. So it would be using some of them probably regardless, and the Russians have used them. So when Russia says that they will threaten to use more of them, they may use more of them, but they were, in the first month of the war, there were 24 instances of them using cluster munitions, and they were trying to use them when they were trying to advance in multiple directions on Kiev, on Kharkiv, in Donbass. The second thing is that Ukraine's counteroffensive right now is moving at a relatively slow pace. And that's because of the intensity of Russia's fortifications, the fact that Russian forces have gotten more sophisticated in terms of rebuffing Ukrainian forces. They can use ATAGMs, for example, and attack helicopters and take advantage of the Ukrainians getting stuck in the mud in the fortifications and attack and disperse units. They've been more effective at jamming HIMARS and other systems, and they've been able to adapt to it. They're fighting alongside a single one or two axes of advance with more of a traditional Soviet-Russian doctrine instead of just the kind of chaos that we saw during the early days of the war. And they got more people. They got 300,000 conscripts brought in, plus now another 128,000, I think, brought in the first half of this year. So they don't have the manpower shortages that they had before. Even with Wagner out of the table, Wagner are offensive units, they're not defensive units. So I think that given the slow pace of the Ukrainian counteroffensive and the fact that Ukrainian cities are being pummeled relentlessly by not just by Russian potential cluster munitions use, but also, of course, the daily bombardments of strikes, right? And of Iranian drones, as you just mentioned before. And I think that this is just something that gives Ukraine another small step towards leveling the playing field. Of course, it's not what the Ukrainians really want, which is aviation and F-16s and ATACMS, long-range missiles. So whether Russia can jam those like the way they've done with HIMARS, that's a question. But jets are what they really want. But this is just another thing that could help them in a small way at this difficult time in their counteroffensive.
Yeah. Well, thinking a little bit about the future, the conclusion of your book, it is subtitled Russia in 2023. A year of implosion with a question mark.
Yeah.
Explain that.
So, well, I think that there's many ways in which Russia could implode in 2023. I think that it's we almost already saw an example of it just on display last month. If the Prigozhin coup had not necessarily succeeded, but also not failed, substantial parts of the Rosguardia and the Russian military and Russian regional governors followed the path of Rostov and handed over to support to Prigozhin, and people like Suravikin worked on his side, we could have been seeing something resembling what we're seeing play out in Sudan right now, a clash between the National Army and a powerful paramilitary force, a civil war occurring in the face of an interstate war. And that would have been something that could have led to a complete destabilization of Russia and its power circles. And the threat of ultranationalists inside Russia to the Kremlin as the war continues to go badly is certainly something that is a major concern. We're seeing the Russian economy hold up much more resiliently than expected, in part because they've been able to sanctions proof themselves over the past decade. They've been able to redirect a lot of the raw material supplies to the collective non-West. They've also been able to get semiconductors and other tech products from countries like China, Turkey, the UAE. But this is when I was saying implosion, I was thinking about a scenario where a perfect storm happens. The economic sanctions really start beginning to bite stronger than before. And Russia engages in reckless moves, like potentially attacking Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant or blocking the Black Sea grain deal, which they've already done, or even experiments with tactical nuclear weapons, at least to the world, isolating them. And then clashes break out internally between the ultranationalists who are dissatisfied with the Russian military and the Russian military. And you see some kind of a mix of this Soviet Civil War, 1917, and the 1990s economic crash all happen at once. And that potentially leads to the worst-case scenario for Russia, a destabilization of central authority, a failed state, the regions breaking off. I mean, so I don't think that's a likely scenario, but I just wanted to raise the question and the specter, because it's ironic that Russia wanted to destroy Ukraine. They wanted to disunite Ukraine, to wipe it off the map, and create a failed state in Ukraine, even if it didn't succeed militarily. And all it's done after 1 year of war, a year and a half of war, is risk creating a failed state in Russia. It's more likely there's going to be a failed state and chaos in Russia than there is to see Ukraine being wiped off, which is an irony from Putin's perspective.
Well, I know you said it's not likely, but if you were to put a percentage on it, if you can, like what is the percentage likeliness that Russia sees an implosion in 2023, you think?
Along the lines that I was just describing, with many of those facets, probably between 5 and 10%. So I would rate it relatively low. I think that the swift defeat of the Prigozhin coup and Prigozhin returning to Belarus will probably discourage somebody else from doing that in the very near future, but not in the longer term future, because Putin was also exposed to being internationally isolated. I mean, only Cuba, North Korea, and Venezuela came out in support of them, and all three of those came out in support of him after Prigozhin went to Belarus. China said nothing. Iran didn't take his side. There were lots of weaknesses. And also, even though there, many people were making bland statements for unity, there certainly was not a pro-Putin mobilization. It's the apathy that the Russian public and Russian propaganda puts on the Russian people to ignore war crimes and to ignore the war in Ukraine. That same kind of apathy now seems to be extending to Putin's leadership. There isn't the kind of mobilization like we saw against the Orange Revolution, pro-Putin nationalism coming from groups like Nashi and young people and students kind of joining that. That doesn't exist anymore. So I think that Putin has got serious vulnerabilities to an internal challenge, and there are a lot of potential, given depending on Russia's actions, for Russia to become more isolated and to have economic shocks. But I also think that that with the Prigozhin mutiny being diffused, with the non-West largely standing behind Russia in some way, shape, or form, he's probably the worst case scenario is most likely going to be averted.
Well, you mentioned the grain embargo.
Yeah.
And so like this week, as we're recording, Russia has put a blockade on Ukraine. I believe Ukraine in response put a naval blockade on Russia. How significant is what's developing the naval situation? How significant is that right now?
So the Boxy Grain deal's collapse is something that was won by Prigozhin. It was wanted by other hardliners who don't want any kind of diplomacy with Ukraine, and also who believe that the grain fertilizer from Russia was being sanctioned or was not being allowed to enter international markets in a free and fair way. So they saw the deal as inequitable and unjust. So I think from a lot of nationalists at home will greet this as a positive and belated move that was necessary to undertake. I think that was the primary impetus behind Putin's decision to suspend the grain deal this time instead of just doing the 60-day extension and expressing dissatisfaction like he was doing the previous few times. Also, the Ukrainian strike on the Crimean Bridge, which happened right at the same time, and more Ukrainian drone strikes on Crimea itself, gave Russia a segue to and a pretext to leave because it was saying that Ukraine was threatening Black Sea shipping and Black Sea security and especially militarizing the Black Sea. So we have to treat all goods, whether they be grain, as the equivalent of arms caches or the equivalent of military components coming out. So that those incidents also gave Putin a way out. And finally, I think the other thing that gave Putin a way out was the recent decline in relations between Russia and Turkey. Russia and Turkey releasing the Azov Battalion members who were traded from Medvedchuk ahead of schedule. They're supposed to stay in Turkey till the end of the war. They were released to return. Turkey is supporting the Ukraine's fast-track accession to NATO. And Turkey continuing to expand drone and even to some extent greenlighting the cluster munition shipments to Ukraine, as well as Turkey's refusal to withdraw from northern Syria, which was a command from Assad. All these things happening at once, and the anti-Turkish campaign that was being fired up in the Russian media, where basically they were trying to talk about how Turkey is in a position of weakness, that Erdogan is needed Putin's help in 2016 after the coup because he was alienated from the West. Those kind of, I think that given the fact that Turkey was the key guarantor of this and the relationship is under strain right now, I think Vladimir Putin also felt it would be okay to get out and to leave. The question is, what comes next? Obviously, leaving the grain deal in the long term is going to be bad for Russia's image in the global south, even if African leaders are keeping mysteriously quiet about this. And having the image of starving the world is certainly not a good one when you're dependent on the global south. So that's something that needs to get resolved. Also, Russia doesn't have the ability to blockade the Black Sea anymore. I mean, they've lost the Moskva. And also, too many of their naval carriers are vulnerable to Ukrainian Neptune missiles, as well as Western-made anti-ship missiles that have come in since the Moscow sinking. So I think that Russia lacks that. Russia's only recourse right now is to stall inspections wherever the grain is still coming out, and also to bomb and attack Ukrainian port infrastructure with Shahed drones and with also with missile, cruise missiles and other strikes. And we're seeing that happening in Odessa on a day-to-day basis. So I think the fastest way to get Russia back into the grain deal is to make sure that the air defense systems in Kiev are working extremely well, and they're limiting major attacks on the capital. Getting those kind of air defense systems or air defense equipment somehow being moved to Odessa right now, to Ukraine's grain ports, and securing them would probably be the fastest way for Russia to recognize that its war on grain shipments is going to do more harm than good, and it has to go there. Or less likely, if African leaders just simply don't turn out next week at the summit, or there's some kind of friction about this, then maybe he might want to go back to the drawing board. Or some kind of hidden pressure from China, which was also standing to lose from this disruption in grain, and is seeing food price inflation. That's concerning to it. India is also seeing the same kind of thing. So maybe pressure from China and India might be what moves it too.
So you would say it's pretty unlikely that Russian ships start sinking merchant vessels coming out of Ukraine carrying grain shipments?
It's possible that they could try to do that and do so in a relatively deniable fashion, and by claiming that they were arms shipments and then the type of stuff coming through from there, creating a bit of a crisis and creating an escalation. I think that I would not rule that out. But I think that it's not the most likely outcome, because Russia is having strains in relations with Turkey, but Turkey's also not sanctioning Russia. It's the only NATO country that's really not sanctioning Russia, and it's allowing Russian energy to reach Europe, and it's allowing Russian to get access to technology. Many Russian nationals and tech companies have relocated there to do business. So I don't think they really want to push the boundaries of their relations with Turkey from a period of tension into a full-blown crisis. So I don't think that they're going to necessarily engage in measures like that, but also them rejoining the grain deal as it was and complying with it in the full spirit of how it was intended, I think is also unlikely too. So it's going to be an intense back and forth here, whether we wait and see what happens.
Well, Samuel, this has been a terrific interview. You've given such thoughtful answers to my questions. One last question I've got for you here is, what are you hoping that readers take away from your book?
Well, I'm thinking that people should really place the Ukraine war into its global context. I think that the point that you made at the very start, I think, was very important. It's important to recognize that this war in Ukraine is not just about poking the nose of the West or poking the nose of NATO or trying to just recapture the Soviet Union for the sake of recapturing it. It's also about recreating an identity inside Russia that's conservative and liberal. It's about uniting the Russian people. And it's about presenting Russia as some kind of a vanguard inside the multipolar world order. So it's about Russia's vision of a world order, Russia's aversion to liberal democracy and willingness to resist it, and Russia's desire to construct an identity at home. The origins of this war are not based on external provocations. They're based on how Vladimir Putin sees his regime's stability and legitimacy, and also forces from within, nationalist forces and illiberal forces that are coming from within. So we should always look inside Russia to understand what Russia's going to do next, because that's the best indicator, and not to be so focused on the external triggers and the external stimuli. Oh,
wonderful. Well, if folks want to stay in touch with your work, if they want to follow what you're doing, are you on social media? How can people stay in touch with what you're doing?
Sure. The main place where I post everything all ubiquitously is on Twitter at SamRamini2. And I've got over 200,000 followers there. I've got all my interviews, my links to my publications there on a regular basis. So just keep an eye, as well as my day-to-day thoughts on what's happening with events in Russia and Ukraine, and also further afield. I stretch a pretty wide net there.
Would you say a Twitter implosion is more likely than a Russia implosion?
Sadly, I think yes. Yeah, right now, yeah. It's every week. It's every week. You wonder what he's going to come up with next, right?
Yeah. Samuel Ramini, Putin's War on Ukraine, Russia's Campaign for a Global Counter-Revolution. Go buy a copy. Go check it out from your library. Some really great information in here. And Samuel, again, thank you so much for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you so much, AJ.